government, but sort of the population generally kind of learned a lesson from the alternative approval process and how unfair it seemed for such a big issue. And so this time, the politicians, I mean, we're talking about more or less a completely different set of politicians, but still many of them had observed what had happened in the past, decided we don't want to go through that again. We'll just go straight to referendum. In this case, the Yes campaign, which was fairly well organized, you know, they got started early, I think even in December. The moment the referendum was announced, pretty soon afterwards, they had signs, they had a website. And on referendum day, I actually was at Crystal Pool or nearby there. And the Yes campaign had an information booth set up out front. They were sort of buttonholing everybody who was coming by, going in or coming out of the pool, asking them if they'd voted and telling them where to vote. And the Yes campaign told me that they had four other booths spread across the city of Victoria. So they did have a dedicated team of volunteers that were out there sort of making sure that people voted, and that probably gave them the edge.
And these are people that just really like swimming, or is it something else?
It varied, I think, the reasons why people voted yes. Some people are swimmers, like dedicated swimmers. Two of the most vocal proponents for the pool. One is someone who trains people who have various disabilities using swimming as therapy. And then another one was a former triathlete. But I think other people who were involved in the Yes campaign, there were sort of a variety of reasons, and probably the most compelling and what tipped it, I think, for a lot of people was people felt that previous generations had paid for infrastructure that they got to enjoy, and so they felt that it was their responsibility to pay it forward for future generations to be able to enjoy similar or better facilities themselves, especially if young parents wanted their kids to have a top-notch facility and wanted their kids to be able to learn how to swim in such a facility. Mm. And so they were strongly motivated to vote yes. And then there were other people, I think, just we're in a government town, and there are lots of people in town who I think generally believe in government and trust local government and want to support its projects and want to support new infrastructure being built. And the property tax implications are not such a concern for them.
There was the two questions then now, Ross, about how to proceed. The referendum was on, should we proceed with this plan? And then there was a secondary question of how we should proceed. The two are the Central Park North and the Central Park South options. What are these?
There was, when the instructions were given to the city staff to proceed with the referendum, I guess this was last autumn, they also wanted some information back from the city staff and the consultants about whether it was possible to put the pool in some other location, not in Central Park, which is the park there on Quadra and just south of Bay. And there was some talk, or they got consultants to look at possibly putting it in the parking lot next to the Royal Athletic Park on Caledonia. And the consultant said, well, we wouldn't do that because it's sort of constrained space-wise, that site, and we really have done no geotechnical analysis, so there are a lot more unknowns. They felt that keeping it in Central Park was closer to what they had initially planned. I mean, the thing is, we're talking about plans that were drafted really back in 2015, 2016, 2017 by a completely different council. And then everything was put on hold for a bunch of different reasons, partly COVID. And so a lot of this stuff was sort of dusted off. And the plan that existed 10 years ago was to build the new pool in the south side of Central Park next to the old pool, which is on the north side of Central Park.
Where the tennis courts and basketball courts are
exactly.
Now.
And so that would, the idea there was that would enable, you could keep the old pool open as long as possible. And so you could have sort of people could swim continuously. And then, you know, once the new pool opens, everyone could move over there and then they could demolish the old one. But as time went on, And in this current iteration, upon further sort of examination, the city staff really sort of pushed the idea that they should build it in Central Park North, which is the site of the existing pool. And the reasons for that were, well, quite a number of them. I mean, there was opposition to building the pool in Central Park South because of there are dozens of mature trees on that side of the park, a whole bunch of which would have to be removed. Plus, as you mentioned, the basketball courts, the tennis courts, which are quite well used, those would have to be removed and then put somewhere else, maybe, but there would be no place to put them until you demolish the old pool. So that was the south option. The other problem with the south option that the city saw was geotechnically, it's less well known. There's apparently all sorts of bedrock down there. And the reason why that's important is because the new facility, not only do you have to blast down to create a pit for the tanks of the pool, but this facility is also supposed to have underground parking, which requires going even deeper. So there'd be a lot of blasting that would have to go if you go in the Central Park or the south option. And there was also concern that even if the main reason why you were doing that was to keep the old pool open as long as possible. But if you're doing all this blasting and the old pool is as fragile as everyone says, then you may just crack the tank of the old pool with all the blasting, and then you'll have to shut the old pool anyway. So the city staff and consultants just thought it was way more predictable to recommend the north option, and they really pushed that to council. They said, just go to a referendum with the north option only, but council wanted to have this possibility to keep the old pool open. And so that's why there was this choice on the ballot. But as it turned out, the decision, I guess, people did know about these things, and they also knew that it was going to be slightly cheaper to go with the north option. And so that got whatever it was, 65% or something like that of the vote. The majority of the votes on that sort of non-binding question was to go with the north and to build it on the site of the existing pool. So this is something that the council will have to decide soon. They've got the mandate to borrow the money because of the main question on the referendum, but they still have to decide whether they're going to build it north or south. But it seems fairly clear that the majority of people who voted on that question wanted it north. So that's probably what's going to happen.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Ross Crockford. Ross is an award-winning journalist, editor, author, civic activist, and co-founder of the watchdog website, johnsonstreetbridge.org. He's two recipient of a Western Magazine Award for Business Writing, the Jack Webster Award of Distinction for Investigative Reporting, and the National Magazine Award for Sports Writing. He's also a regular contributor to Victoria's Focus magazine. His latest article up there is, "How Much Would It Cost to Fix the Crystal Pool?" Well, how about that now, Ross? We've seen which way the winds have blown on the referendum decision. Your article talks about the other option of not replacing, but fixing what exists. And it looks like, just as in the case of the Johnson Street Bridge so many eons ago, that there's a much, much, much cheaper way to go.
Yeah. So over the Christmas holidays, I was sitting with some friends, people that I actually know from back in the sort of Johnson Street Bridge time. And we were talking about the old pool, and one of them said, well, what exactly is the condition of the old pool? I mean, we keep hearing in the rhetoric of some of the councillors and the city, it's that everything is past its expiry date, that the pool is sort of could close at any minute because everything, all of its components are going to fail, or there's a risk that they're going to fail. So we just said, okay, well, these are statements, but is there any kind of report, or are there any documents? And so we went back through the sort of last report that was given to the councillors in June of last year, and which was only talking about sort of the new facility, really, and how much it would cost. And that was the main thing that made the news at the time, was that the price of the new facility was going to be over $200 million, which was a real shock to the councillors, because when the new facility was last talked about back in 2017, 2018, it was on the order of $70 million. So that's what got all the attention. But buried in that report was, it's like a 55-page document or something like that. There were references to a condition assessment, and that's a sort of standard practice if you're the owner of a facility to get an engineer in to basically go through the building and identify the status of all of the parts and components of the building and see how they're holding up and provide an evaluation. And this condition assessment was not included in the report. So I filed a Freedom of Information request for it and then realized it's like, well, time is running short before we get to the referendum. So I just did a little more digging and I actually managed to get a copy of it. And the report, the condition assessment is in two parts. And it was not really easy to read. The first part was a letter that sort of set out the terms and sort of limitations of the second document. And the second document is what was called the capital plan. And it basically laid out every single element of the pool, whether it was the waterproofing or the drainage system or the roof or the skylight, and then provided an evaluation of each and every one of those items, and then had a number amount attached to them. And when I added up the number amounts for all of those items, every element of the pool, that came to $17.4 million, which is a lot less than $209 million. But I had to ask the engineer who created the report a couple of questions. And the big one was, okay, so if you spend the money that's listed there, is that just like the duct tape repair, or does that put it back into good condition? And the way the people who do this building science and evaluations of structures is that they basically rate things. And sometimes it's numerical, but often it's just with a sort of green, yellow, red kind of rating, good, fair, and poor. And so a bunch of elements of the pool were in good condition because some of them had actually been repaired quite recently. The city actually replaced the boilers in the pool just like 2 years ago. And a bunch of things, parts of the electrical system were still, largely unchanged. I mean, they were outdated, but they were still functioning okay. But there were certain elements that were red listed that were in poor condition, and that was specifically the old domed skylights, which were still original to the old pool, the waterproofing of the pool, which was last done in 1995, and then the drainage system had a whole bunch of issues. So, when you added up those items, the items that were sort of critical, then you were talking only about $10 or $11 million. And so I had to talk to the engineer just to clarify. I said, okay, so if you spend this $11 million or spend the $17 million on everything, does that put everything back into good condition? And he said yes. And does the report cover all the components of the pool? And he said yes. So what you didn't have it wasn't really like a formal analysis of saying, here's a plan of how to do it. Although it did outline sort of here's how you could spend the money over the course of 5 years. And it would require shutting the old pool down for a substantial period of time. I mean, just replacing the skylights was going to take 6 months, but you could do other work at the same time. So maybe you'd be looking at a year closure of the pool, but you'd only end up spending, I mean, it would be more than $17.4 million, but say it was, even if it was double that, $34-35 million, that's still a lot less than $209 million.
So, well, and $209 million, that is a pretty rosy estimate too, and we saw what happened with the Johnson Street Bridge when estimates all of a sudden are over the moon.
Yes. and the thing is, as was pointed out with the bridge, the advantage of repairing things is that you can also sort of phase it in over time. You don't have to do it all at once. But if you're building something new, you can't stop. If your project stalls out, it can stall out for a very long time, in which case the the stuff that you've built actually starts to age and deteriorate. It's exposed to the elements. We've had that with buildings that have been built under under construction, where suddenly the financing has disappeared and then you just have a pit sitting there. So the problem with the new build is that you are committed to do it, and if prices suddenly go completely haywire because of Trump's tariffs or who knows what, you have no choice. You've got to pay the money to keep going. Whereas in the case of repairing the pool, you know, you could do some of it now, do another closure in a couple of years, and major closure in a couple of years, and do more of the work and things like that, and just sort of spread out the costs over time. So, but anyway, this report, the interesting thing was that it was not presented to the councillors. They were not given this option, there was any indication that there was this report that said you could sort of put the old pool into good condition for $17 million. I showed the report to a couple of councillors, and they didn't recall ever seeing it, although two of the councillors who were the major proponents for the new pool did say, that this is not news. You know, and there were various stories. One was that, that's money from, or that's a 2011 report. And I had to point out, it's like, well, no, actually it says this price tag, $17.4 million, is quoted directly in 2024 dollars. The report specifically says that. And then there was also a story from one of the counselors. We were presented with an option of doing a repair to the pool for $9 million, and we rejected that. And to which I said, what? Where was this discussed? Like, I don't recall any attending any kind of discussion or hearing about any discussion where you were told that it could be fixed for $9 million and you rejected it. So as far as I can tell, this report was not presented to the councillors. Now, what's interesting is the previous council passed back in 2012, I think it is, a policy. It established a policy that any report by a third party that has budgetary implications of $1 million or more are to be forwarded to the council. And I don't know if that policy is still being followed or not. The city used to post every quarter a list of these reports that had been presented. But there's still a lot of wriggle room in this policy that the reports can be presented to the council in closed meetings. So the public has no idea, you know, what is said around these reports or how they're given or if they're given. And which is crucial, because when you look at this document that I got, it's not immediately apparent sort of the $17.4 million price tag. Like, I had to go through it and add things up and get confirmation from the engineer. So if the staff or the consultants are not framing the report, even if they are presenting it to the counselors, but not specifically telling them, oh, by the way, we have this report saying you can repair the pool for $17.4 million, they might just say, okay, thanks for yet another document, and then move on. So that is an issue, and I think a very live issue, is, you know, what happens when you have significant information that should frame the decisions of elected officials, and it is not being presented to them. And this is really interesting that it's also happening in the context of UVic, and I don't know if you've been following what's been going on with UVic's McKinnon pool, but Wayne Kelly, who is the guy who's sort of spearheading the charge to try to save McKinnon pool, which UVic has said it has to close because it has closed it, but it says it's not going to reopen McKinnon pool because it needs $1.5 million worth of repairs. And Wayne Kelly did a Freedom of Information request, and he found reports from engineers saying pool's in good shape, and it only needs $166,000 worth of repairs. And so, you know, this is another situation where you have information which has been given to people inside the bureaucracy who have decided that they It's not to be made public and not to be shared with the people at the top who make the decisions. And there's never any investigation as to why they made these decisions, and they certainly never end up taking responsibility for the fact that they withheld information from elected officials. And that is a pattern that I think is repeating and is quite dangerous for the governance of any kind of institution.
And this is where I come back to the familiar ring where the arena and the Johnson Street Bridge, where we ended up. What was the final tally for that bridge, the final cost? I know it was over $100
million. $105, $106
million. For a 75-foot span or something? That because it can, because it's cantilevered and goes up and down for the amusement of the tourists, but also to service to the business interests of a very small number of upstream businesses, you know, we're on the hook for $100 million bridge.
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, according to Transport Canada, that is, it's considered a navigable waterway. And so the city was obligated to put in a movable bridge unless it applied to Transport Canada to have that status removed. But I think the shipyard and the gravel pit and the metal scrap yard and various other things that move large vessels through there really motivated the city council to preserve that designation. So that's a big part of why it's still a movable bridge. But in relation to the bridge, I mean, just for background. So, I mean, what happened way back when was that there was, at the time that the city council was really pushing the idea of building that new bridge, the staff of the city had buried two reports, one about the Crystal Pool, about the condition of the Crystal Pool, and that there were a bunch of things in it that needed to be fixed. And then another report about the old fire hall on Yates Street that in an earthquake, it would collapse. And so you would be without fire trucks in the event an earthquake. So, you know, that was completely outrageous that these reports had been hidden. But again, no one got sacked for the fact that they had hidden reports, and there was not really any kind of investigation into who had hidden them or why. But it did result in this policy, as I said, that the council created in 2012, saying that, well, you're required to bring these reports forward, but do it in a closed meeting. And there's not really any kind of pressure on this, you know, on the city to make these reports public. So that's something that has to change.
Now we're fast running out of time, Ross, but I mean, in looking at your article, and again, it's at focusonvictoria.ca, how much would it cost to fix the Crystal Pool? There is a mock-up of, or at the city site, rather, at the City of Victoria site, they've got like a mock-up of what the proposed new pool will look like. It's by the firm that you mentioned in your article, HCMA. Is that the final design? Is that what's going forward, or do we know yet what new pool will look like?
Those are renderings. They're not a design. This is the funny thing is there was sort of further discussion that happened in 2018 where they sort of consulted with the public, you know, what do you want to see in a new pool? So all sorts of, there were a whole bunch of things were added in. And we know what those elements are. There's a half gym. There's a lap pool, 50-meter lap pool, but there's also a teaching pool, 25-meter teaching pool. There's big fitness studio, community meeting rooms, all this. So we know that it's going to contain all that. But there's no actual formal design or and certainly not architectural drawings. That is what is going to happen now because the money has been approved. And especially if it's on the north site, I mean, there really is no sort of architectural drawing for that at all. So I think the intent is that it's going to have lots of space and it's going to have lots of light. those are just artists' renderings of what the new pool could look like, not what it's going to look like.
And just to remind that the north option means that the existing pool and facility will be leveled first, and then they're going to start from scratch. Well, Ross, my own thinking about this, and again, this is a small city. As you said, 120,000 voting members or something like that, citizens. That's a lot of money, 200 and whatever it ends up being, millions to be paying for years and years, paying for it, as you mentioned, as a debt to future generations and so forth. I wonder if there has been any social uplift worked into this plan. We have just a kilometer away from that site, Pandora and Quadra Street. Anybody who lives in the city knows what that means. There's homeless people by the hundreds. The numbers are in dispute as well, but over 1,000 from reputable estimates. Is there anything that this pool is going to do for those kinds of citizens? Any bathing and hygiene, laundry, storage for bicycles and belongings, anything like that to address that other part of the citizenry of Victoria?
Well, that's not really been included yet. Now that we do have a yes vote, it will be interesting to see if there is some pressure to put more of those concerns into the facility. Certainly several of the councillors have expressed, before this vote went ahead, great reservations that this pool was basically going to overwhelm the budget of the city and prevent it from doing all the other things that it has to do, and which includes housing initiatives and also supporting the arts, and not to mention all the other big capital projects that the city has been thinking about, like a library or renovating Ship Point. So now that everything is, the pool is basically going to sort of swallow everything else, there may be pressure to try to get some more of those concerns addressed in the facility. The problem is that once you start monkeying with the design or adding more elements to it, then you get what's called scope creep, which means that the project becomes even more expensive. So shall we say, just the end of the beginning, but it's certainly we're nowhere near the end of this thing.
No, now we're getting Churchillian. This is getting more expensive by the moment. Editor at Focus on Victoria, or one of them, Leslie Campbell, our publisher, she has also written on this: let's force the city to re-examine retrofitting the Crystal Pool. That obviously didn't happen. Focus on Victoria is a staple here. It has been for many years. They're online now, focusonvictoria.ca. I expect, Ross, that you'll be following up on this as this develops. You and David Broadland, as you guys put so much work into what I still think of as a fiasco of the Johnson Street Bridge, considering we're going to be paying for that for generations as well.
Yeah, well, I filed more Freedom of Information requests, so you just have to watch the website to see what we turn up.
Stay tuned to this channel. Ross Crawford, thanks a lot for coming on and talking about it with us today.
You're very welcome.
I also want to thank Eve Engler. Go over to his site, eveengler.com. It's all I've got for this week. Until the next time, thanks again, Ross.
Thank you.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favourite uncle that's taken you for walks in the park, but that he's really a serial abuser.
You need a different source. Guerrilla Radio, a century of news every Thursday and Saturday.
A Renaissance Coffee is open at SFU. Parminder and his team have been serving the SFU community with great coffee for more than 20 years. If you're looking for a wholesome meal, delectable desserts, or something to warm yourself and lift your spirits, Renaissance Cafe is a place to be. featuring fair trade espresso beverages and brewed coffee. Renaissance Coffee is open Monday to Friday from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. Well, how do you get up and go?